a debt ceiling deal reached. Pence poised to enter the presidential race, plus the lottery stays passive, and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 2nd, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, President Joe Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy struck a deal that will avoid an unprecedented and catastrophic default on the country's debt. The bipartisan agreement contains both suspension of the debt limit and a package of spending cuts. Those cuts include limits on federal spending, taking back $27 billion in funds meant to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, and new work requirements for people on SNAP and TANF, food stamps and welfare benefits. The bill garnered strong support from both sides of the aisle in the House. Seven members of Indiana's House delegation voted in favor, with only Republican Victoria Spartz casting a no vote. Jim Banks, who's running for the U.S. Senate, told multiple radio stations this week he would vote against the measure, but did not actually cast a vote. Whose position is strengthened by the debt ceiling deal? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwaners, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And O'Shea Boyd, public engagement editor for the Indianapolis Star. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, this was a big test, particularly for Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who has a very narrow majority, right, and some folks in his caucus who haven't been a big fan of his from the start. Did he come out of this in a stronger position?
Oh, I think he probably did. And he certainly can. He can point to the cuts, or what purport to be cuts, in the budget to say that he wrested some concessions from the president. Actually, it's a good thing all the way around. And it, as the Republicans said, it was the most important piece of legislation that they were facing, okay? And meanwhile, Jim Banks, who wants to be a senator from Indiana, skated, okay? He didn't cast his vote on this most important piece of legislation. Mike Braun, who wants to manage our state's finances, was willing to let us default on our debt nationally with the catastrophic results that would have. Only Todd Young and some members of the House stood up and said, no, I'm going to do what's good for the country. Neither Mike Braun nor Jim Banks had that in their frame of reference at all.
Yeah, almost every member of the Indiana House delegation voted for this. Todd Young called it, he said, you know, this didn't go as far as he would have liked in terms of reining in spending, but it was a compromise that was necessary. Is that a good way to describe what this outcome is?
Yeah, he's a realist. Right. And basically what he said was we cut the best deal we could, given the political realities and the math involved. Right. So cut a deal. The interesting thing with Speaker McCarthy. So a part of the deal he had to cut with the Freedom Caucus was this motion to vacate only requires one person to file it. Right. To vacate the speakership and basically remove him. It would have been smart, and maybe it happened, that McCarthy's the best-case scenario Republican speaker for Joe Biden. So if you're in there cutting this deal, you've marginalized further the far right in the Freedom Caucus because you needed Democrats to get this done, right? Okay, well, now pretend you file a motion to vacate, you're going to kick the speaker out. You need Democrats to keep him. Like, the reality is you're going to have a Republican leader. And so what the Freedom Caucus showed was you let them call the shots and not give any Democrat support to these things that we have to do together, then you're going to have a way worse outcome. So it'll be interesting to see if the Freedom Caucus puts their money where their mouth is, because they might lose again, and they might lose with Democrat votes.
Yeah. The intricacies of the deal itself, first of all, very few people understand how the debt ceiling works. And then when we're talking about things like...
That's in Congress you're talking about. Very good.
Yes. Yeah. When we're talking about things like, you know, a debt, you know, COVID-19 rescission and federal spending caps for the next 2 years... These are very minute, detailed kind of things that the average person doesn't know about, probably doesn't care that much about. So when you look at it at a high level, how do you define success here?
You know, I don't think the impact, to your point, is nearly as important as the perception here. I think most Americans won't notice any difference. Yes, if you have SNAP benefits, there are new work requirements for certain to receive certain types of assistance. they'll notice it. There might be some other individuals who might see something here or there. But when you look at, for instance, funding for the IRS, very controversial aspect of what was done by the Biden administration and Congress last budget cycle, you know, $80 billion to hire new agents. Well, I think, what, 10, a percentage of that, 10 or 15 billion
ten,
is coming,
ten
is coming out.
Well, but it's coming back.
But well, you're, that's
it's just
the it's not going to.
But that's the,
IRS. The
game, I guess. No one who's no taxpayer is going to notice the difference. I guess is my point. What the fascinating thing here is to watch the spin. Normally, when you have a deal, both sides come together and say, shake hands and say, we all gave, but we all got something. This time, it's basically both sides rushing to spin people, saying we really screwed the other people. I mean, they are screwed.
You know,
and in fact, now the president has said he wants to have a national address, a television address, at which point apparently that's when he's going to sign this. So I think he has the bully pulpit and the last word in terms of saying, look, I came out on top.
Can I make a point to your – no one knows what the heck this debt ceiling thing is. Like, who's paying attention to this? The average person has no clue. And will the average person know if my SNAP benefits are lessened or lowered or cut off? It's because of the debt ceiling. I don't think anybody really knows what this is. It's just too nuanced. Mm-hmm. And I know that – the Republicans and Democrats are fighting over it, but to the average person, I don't know that they're paying attention at all. I think we pay attention, but I don't know that they are.
Well, that's why perception probably
it's perception about perception that we did our
also,
part.
Right. The average person also doesn't trust either side to actually reduce this, if that's your goal.
Yeah. Yes.
Because, you know, under Trump, we went from $19 trillion to $25 trillion. Now we're going from $26 trillion to $32 trillion. Nobody's looking at either side going,
and
we can trust
them. The proof of that pudding is that the Clinton tax proposal, when he was in office, would have eliminated the debt. And what did the Republicans do as soon as they got control? Cut it out. It's important to note that the only time we face this debt ceiling crisis is when we have a Democrat in the White House and we have Republican control of one of the houses. That's when we face this. Donald Trump got his passed, three or four times during his administration with no fuss about it. It's only the Republicans doing it.
We'll go back to the patriarch. Ronald Reagan's budget cuts set the stage for George Bush to break his famous read my lips, no new taxes, and was inheriting sort of the gap that was created for him by his predecessor.
Should have listened to Clinton.
Multiple reports this week say former Vice President and Indiana Governor Mike Pence will launch a campaign for president on June 7th. The sources that fed the reporting of Pence's pending announcement said the launch will come via a video and a speech in Iowa. There have been a flurry of presidential campaign launches on the Republican side in recent weeks. That includes Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, and former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. Also rumored to join the campaign in the coming days are former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum. Pence will join a Republican field that includes former President Donald Trump, former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, and former tech and finance CEO Vivek Ramaswamy. Mike O'Brien, quite frankly, is there any path for Mike Pence?
You could ask the same question about any of the 40 people we just listed
off,
except Donald Trump. It's,
and Ron DeSantis.
It feels maybe
like
ran
one,
Ron DeSantis,
one of the two of them.
Look, I think Pence, whether he ran or not, is going to play a really important role in this primary, especially in the primary, but potentially in the general election. He's the only other guy on that stage that knows what actually happened. What was actually happening in that White House? So Trump's going to say whatever he wants to say. True or not? Probably not.
Always the case.
And Mike Pence at least has the credibility coming out of the end, the way that administration ended, with some people. Average, certainly not the far right or the Freedom Caucus that think he should overturn the election single-handedly. But he does have some credibility, and he knows. He's the only guy on that stage can say, here's what we did, and here's what I like that we did. Here's what didn't ever actually happen that Donald Trump is saying happened or that we did, and here's what I didn't like. Is there a path there? They're front-loading heavy in Iowa, front-loading heavy in New Hampshire, North Carolina. You catch one of those, maybe. I mean, you never know on these. At this point, you can't say absolutely not, but it's a long shot, but it's a long shot for all of them.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me you have different people trying to occupy certain lanes, which is the case anytime you get a loaded primary. But you have Trump and DeSantis vying for that lane.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have a lot of these other folks, Christie, who's been an outspoken critic of Trump,
You have Doug Burgum, who's trying to do the, I'm just a normal guy trying to chart a path for the Republicans. You know, you have folks like that. Mike Pence feels like that's going to be his lane, but is that a winning strategy? I'm guessing you don't think it's a winning strategy.
I think that Mike Pence relies on Dan Quayle for advice, and I think that his campaign and Dan Quayle's campaign, and what was it, 96, that Dan put his toe in the water, and I think he lost it, frostbite at the end. Yeah. Same thing. It's not going anywhere. He doesn't have a constituency. And having listened to Mike.
Jimmy Carter, right?
Well, except there was a difference in that whole situation. But in this particular case, he is as exciting as watching paint dry, okay? I mean, he really is. You listen to him, and it drips sugar every time he talks. And that may do well with the religious right wing, but that's not a big enough caucus to get him a pass to the nomination.
I'll totally take Boren. I'm all for Boren.
We're not at Boren anymore.
Yeah, that's the thing. Is Mike Pence's time to vie for the presidency come and go?
He's a relic. He is a throwback to the past, early 2000s. We're not there anymore. He's not a firebrand. I was thinking he's boring, not in a bad way, but that's kind of how you want your politicians, or we did want our politicians years ago to be this way. That's not what we're looking for today. When you're going against Trump and DeSantis, you can't be no personality. You can't be no personality. You have to have something, and people are looking for that, and he doesn't have it, unfortunately.
Biden's scratching an itch coming out of the Trump administration, right?
It works a little better on the Democratic side right now than it does on the Republican side.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And the problem with Pence has, too, is he knows what went on, but he's trying to walk a line between giving just enough and not criticizing Trump. That's a losing strategy.
You mentioned somebody earlier, who has provided something of a playbook of sorts for Mike Pence, and that is, don't laugh, Jimmy Carter, because in 76, while the much higher-profile candidates like Birch Bayh, like Frank Church, a long list, a lot of them from the U.S. Senate, were busy sort of operating up here. Jimmy Carter went early and often to Iowa and conducted essentially a person-to-person retail kind of campaign. And that's already, according to folks that have been quoted close to the candidate, that he intends to visit all 99 counties in Iowa and very much do is there a diner? Is there a luncheonette that I can go, pop into?
The problem is, the list of candidates who've won Iowa and then went on to get
the nomination.
Absolutely nothing is
the problem. The other problem is, if you do all that, put all your eggs in the Iowa basket, and you don't come out with the results you want, then you're really
messed up. Well, then at least you get out early. Saves money.
It feels like for some of these other folks, success isn't necessarily measured by winning the nomination. And that's often true when you have a big primary. It's, Nikki Haley, is she vying for the vice president slot for whoever the nominee is? Other folks, this is their first time running for president. Are they trying to elevate their profile for the next one?
Sure.
The success for Mike Pence here has got to be only winning the nomination or nothing, right?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think he's vying for the head of the Department of Interior or some he's not some side hustle in federal government.
All right. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, will Mike Pence place better than third in any presidential primary? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, does the Indiana Department of Child Services do a good job? 26% of you say yes, 74% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Hoosier Lottery officials say providing online options to play makes sense for the long-term sustainability of the lottery, but they still won't take an active role in urging lawmakers to make those online options available. Lottery Executive Director Sarah Taylor says legislators are the decision makers. The lottery is there to provide information.
We're always happy to answer questions, and if that changes and we become more advocates, we're happy to engage with them to share the reasons why.
Taylor says it's also important to communicate to its retailers that other states that have added online lottery haven't seen declining sales at those brick-and-mortar sellers. She says that's especially true when lotteries make use of cross-promotions.
Between your current players going in still to retail, but perhaps they want to try online, or you have new online players that also go to retail based on these promotions to encourage them.
An independent legislative analysis this past session suggested brick-and-mortar lottery retailers would be hurt by addition of online lottery.
O'Shea Boyd, if the lottery thinks online games are the way it stays successful, and that's important to the state, we get hundreds of millions of dollars every year from the lottery, should it then be more aggressive in lobbying for those online games?
I feel as if it should. And let me preface this. I don't play the lottery. So I don't have anything. I don't have any stake in this at all. But it seems smart to me to advocate for it to be online and to push people to play online, if that's where the future's going. There are people, I think what they don't want to do is make the retail people upset. That's what I'm getting from this. I think if that's where people are at, that's where the money's at, you got to let, and legislators don't, let's just not say they're out of touch, but let's just say they don't always know where things are headed. And so you need to advocate for them to go with the future. And the future is online.
There's questions about online gaming in general. But when it comes to online lottery, I think there's a question about, is it right to make this easier to play? I mean, do we want to make it easier for folks to play the lottery?
Well, you got to answer the question. The bigger question is, what's the purpose here? Is it to derive tax revenue? If that's what it is, then the goal should be to make it as simple as possible. Now, there are other public policy questions that intersect with that, where you may not want to encourage gaming or make it easy. But that's the big question. And that's why any issue dealing with gaming, back to the first time the Pointer Sisters came here for the announcement with George McGinnis and scratched off the first Indiana ticket. Remember that? It's always the debate there and with riverboats and with the racinos and with live dealers in casinos. And somebody gets hurt every time. If you give more to this person, that part of the sector of the industry gets hurt. And that's always going to be the case. We saw it with online betting on sports. Did it have to go through a brick-and-mortar casino in Indiana, or could it just be right in some other roundabout manner? And that's what ultimately is going on here. Is it, should the agency be, I mean, part of me thinks, and this is somewhat flippant, that there are a lot of people, it seems, in the General Assembly who don't like any agency or any agency that tries to suggest anything. I mean, we've seen pushback, and that part I'm not kidding about. So maybe this is reverse psychology and saying, let's just be quiet, because if we advocate vociferously for it, they might think we're trying to be rogue.
Please, don't put me in that dry patch.
It does seem like a lot of the disagreement here. Now, part of this past session was the online lottery was wrapped up in the larger online gambling bill, and that died for other reasons, and I don't think the lottery was really one of those reasons. It just got caught up in it.
They're part of that bigger question.
But to that point, there is a question, though, of are you going to hurt convenience stores, grocery stores who get these sales? The lottery says no. Do you believe that?
So on the iGaming side, all the studies showed it helped the brick and mortars because you partner with them. And now they have an online option that they never had available to them before. All the studies, national studies, the Gaming Commission's own study said, no, this benefits brick and mortar retailers. The legislative services agency said, no, it doesn't, it hurts them. And now on the lottery, they're saying, no, this doesn't hurt the convenience stores. It actually helps them. And everyone's just like, what are you talking about? Like, if you can
pull a lottery ticket on
your phone, I'm not walking in. I'm going to play the lottery while I'm pumping gas. Right. Why am I going inside? It's just like, it was intuitively just like, it didn't make any sense to anybody when they were making that argument early in the session. But the lottery is part of this bigger, they tried to go it alone and go online a year ago, and the legislature put the brakes on that and made them part of this bigger debate about should we allow an expansion of mobile gaming, whatever it is, whether it's the lottery owned by the government or the casinos owned by, the private casinos industry. Yeah.
To that point, how much of the lottery saying,
we will answer any question you have, but otherwise we're staying out of it. How much of that is they got smacked on the nose pretty good about a year and a half ago when they were all ready to go online before and briefed some legislative leaders about it who were like, oh, yeah, okay. And then lawmakers found out, because of a great story by Nikki Kelly, lawmakers found out just how far the online lottery was going to go and went, whoa, this is not what you told us this was going to be, and absolutely shut them down. Are they a little...
gun-shy?
Pardon the phrase, gun-shy.
Yeah, I think they probably are. But I think there's a more fundamental question to all of this. I mean, you cannot turn on your television without being bombarded by gaming in one form or another. And, you know, where's enough? I mean, when have we reached saturation point? I mean, you've got all these things encouraging people to start out, giving you the first $100 in chances or whatever it is. I don't even know what the term
Betting
is.
Betting deposit or something.
Betting deposits. Yeah. I mean, you're sucking people in who are going to spend a fair amount of their hard-earned money doing this to no avail. That's a concern.
And I'll say credit to State Senator John Ford, who has been one of the leaders on trying to push towards online gaming. He had said, when I talked to him in December, you know, I'm all for this, but with the state doing a much more robust problem gaming program. He's like, I don't know where those dollars are going. I don't think those programs are effective. We need to do a lot better on that.
We don't really have one here.
We don't really have it, at least not a very visible one.
Well, we don't spend a lot on mental health at all.
And we run it through Family and Social Services Agency. So they run it through addictions, which has got their hands full with all the other addictions.
So you're saying we actually care about people who gamble if they're addicted?
I don't think we do.
That's the problem.
No. Yeah, I feel like we're past the morality question. There's a lot of morality questions here, but I thought we were long past that.
Well, we were past it when we went with the state lottery.
Yes.
When the state actually decided you could do
open
gaming. But
to
carry it even further than we've gone, it seems to me we need to have a discussion.
I don't like to play the lottery. I just throw cash out the window.
Well, you might as well.
That's the argument. You're not saturating people that are already in. You're giving access to people that aren't at all. And never will be.
I don't think that's true with the sports gaming. I don't think that's true. I think you're going to have kids, 18, 21-year-old kids playing that.
The comforting thing here.
I mean, quite frankly, Ben Smaltz.
18 and 21-year-old people aren't kids.
Right. They are in my mind.
They're much older than me.
Ben Smaltz, who was the author of the online sports gaming bill in 2019, I think it was. Ben Smaltz, the author of that bill, got up, and I think he voted against the bill overall. He got up on the floor on the final passage of it and said, I don't like this. I don't like the idea of a casino in the home of every Hoosier on their phone. I don't like it. He authored the bill because that's what he was charged to do by the caucus. But he was warning about this then.
Remember, the comfort here for all of us is, we've all been told this, lawmakers in Indiana don't pick winners and losers. We can take that to the bank.
State Representative Jim Lucas was booked into a southern Indiana county jail this week for operating while intoxicated. Indiana State Police arrested the Republican after he allegedly crashed his vehicle on I-65 and drove off. A state police spokesperson says Lucas's vehicle was found by Seymour Police shortly after the crash. Lucas was located nearby and arrested by state police and booked into the Jackson County Jail for operating a vehicle while intoxicated and leaving the scene of a crash that caused property damage. The most serious of those charges would be a Class A misdemeanor, which carries up to 1 year in jail and a $5,000 fine. Lucas is in his fifth term as a state lawmaker. He is considered one of the legislature's most strident advocates to reduce or eliminate gun regulations and has pushed Indiana to legalize cannabis. Lucas has repeatedly courted controversy in his time at the State House, notably for racist social media posts. John Schwanes, if these charges are true, which is, of course, an if at this point, will there be any fallout for Jim Lucas?
There will be, obviously, for him personally, financial and legal implications. But politically, you know, and this is going to sound like a cop-out, this is one of those where it really is up to his constituents. That's who he answers to. There's nothing in state law that says he can't, even if he's convicted, that would bar him from continuing to serve in the General Assembly. That's not the question. Nobody can order his removal. It's not as if the House Speaker or the governor or anybody else. I mean, that's a different branch of government altogether. So he is the only person he really answers to in terms of continuing as a service or not are the people who put them there in the first place. So that's a question for them. And there is precedent here and across the country. A lot of elected officials do from time to time get, you know, in similar predicaments. Mayors we've seen recently in large cities here in the state, other lawmakers across the country. Some have weathered the storm and put it behind them.
Yeah, it remains whether the mayor of Fort Wayne will.
Well, you were more specific than I was. I was being generic.
Well, we talked about it on the show. Realistically, are his constituents going to care?
I don't think so, but maybe this is finally where they draw the line. I doubt it. I mean, he's, what, a fifth-term lawmaker? Yeah. So, and he's done a lot of controversial things over the years, so I don't know if this is where they finally draw the line, but it will be interesting to find out if it is, because we now look at drinking and driving a lot differently than we once did as well. And maybe, too, it's about how apologetic he is, how much he says, you know, this is a mistake, and he'll probably say it was a one-time thing, never driven drunk before, allegedly. So we shall see what happens.
I think if he apologizes, it might be the first time he's apologized. that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Oshia Boyd of the Indy Star. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at WFYI.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.